Detective Duffy, you say you have no reservations at all about the way Andrew Barber conducted this case?
That's right.
Because he didn't know anything, isn't that right?
Yes.
Objection. Leading, this is a prosecution witness.
He can have it.
And how long would you say you've known Andy Barber? How many years?
Objection. Relevance. Overruled.
I guess I've known Andy over 20 years.
So you know him pretty well?
Yes.
Inside and out?
Sure. When did you learn that his father is a murderer?
Boom.
Jonathan and I both shot out of our seats, jostling the table.
Objection!
Sustained.
The witness is instructed not to answer that question, and the jury is to disregard it.
Give it no weight. Treat the question as if it was never asked.
Judge French turned to the lawyers.
I'll see counsel at sidebar right now. I did not go with Jonathan to the sidebar conference, so, again, I am quoting the judge's whispered comments from the trial transcript. But I did watch the judge as he spoke, and I can tell you he was obviously furious. Red-faced, he put his hands on the edge of the judge's bench and leaned over to hiss at LeJudas.
I am shocked. I'm stunned you did that. I explicitly told you in no uncertain terms not to go there, or I would declare a mistrial. What do you have to say, Mr. LeJudas?
It was defense counsel who chose to cross on this question of the character of the defendant's father and the integrity of the investigation. If he chooses to make that an issue, the prosecution is perfectly entitled to argue its side of the case. I was just following up on Mr. Klein's line of questioning. He specifically raised the issue of whether the defendant's father had any reason to suspect his son.
Mr. Klein, I presume you are going to move for a mistrial.
Yup.
Step back. The lawyers went back to their respective tables. Judge French remained standing to address the jury, as was his habit. He even unzipped his robe a bit and gripped the edge of its collar as if he were posing for a statue. Ladies and gentlemen, I am instructing you to ignore that last question. Strike it from your minds entirely. There is a saying in the law that you cannot unring the bell, but I'm going to ask you to do just that. The question was improper and the prosecutor should not have asked it, and I want you to be aware of that. Now, I am going to dismiss you for the day while the court attends to other business. The sequestration order remains in place. I remind you not to talk about this case with anybody at all. Do not listen to media reports about it or read about it in the newspapers. Turn off your radios and TVs. Block yourself off from it entirely. All right. The jury is dismissed. We'll see you tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock sharp. The jury filed out, exchanging looks with each other. A few of them stole glances at LeJudas. When they were gone, the judge said, Mr. Klein? Jonathan stood.
Your Honor, the defendant moves for a mistrial. This issue was the subject of extensive pretrial discussion, the upshot of which was that the issue is so volatile and so prejudicial that mentioning it would result in a mistrial. This was the third rail that the prosecution was explicitly told not to touch. Now he has.
The judge massaged his forehead. Jonathan continued,
If the court is not inclined to declare a mistrial, the defendant will move to expand its witness list by two, Leonard Patz and William Barber.
William Barber is the defendant's grandfather?
Correct. I may need a governor's warrant to get him transported here. But if the prosecution insists on this bizarre insinuation that the defendant somehow is guilty by inheritance, that he is a member of a criminal family, born a murderer, then we have a right to rebut that.
The judge stood there a moment, grinding his molars. I'll take it under advisement. I'll give you my decision in the morning. Court is adjourned till 9 o'clock tomorrow.
Mr. LeJudas.
Before we move on, Mr. Barber, about that knife, the one that was thrown in the lake to throw off the investigators. Do you have any idea who might have planted that knife?
Witness.
Of course. I knew from the start.
Mr. LeJudas.
Did you? And how's that?
Witness.
The knife was missing from our kitchen.
Mr. LeJudas.
An identical knife?
Witness.
A knife that matched the description I'd been given.
I've since seen the knife that was recovered from the pond when we were shown the state's evidence. It's our knife. It was old, pretty distinctive. It did not match the set. I recognized it.
Mr. LeJudas. Then it was thrown in the pond by someone in your family?
Witness. Of course.
Mr. LeJudas.
Jacob? To deflect any inference of guilt from the actual knife he owned?
Witness. No. Jake was too smart for that. And I was, too. I knew what the wounds looked like. I'd talked to the forensics people. I knew that knife couldn't have made Ben Rifkin's wounds.
Mr. LeJudas.
Lori, then?
Why?
Witness.
Because we believed in our son. He told us he didn't do it. We didn't want to see his life ruined just because he'd been foolish enough to buy a knife. We knew people would see that knife and jump to the wrong conclusion. We talked about the danger of it. So Lori decided to give the cops another knife. The only problem was she was the least sophisticated among the three of us about these things, and she was also the most upset. She was not careful enough. She chose the wrong sort of knife. She left a loose end.
Mr. LeJudas.
Did she talk to you before she did this?
Witness.
Before?
No.
Mr. LeJudas.
After, then?
Witness. I confronted her. She did not deny it.
Mr. LeJudas.
And what did you say to this person who just interfered with the homicide investigation?
Witness. What did I say? I said I wished she'd talked to me first. I would have given her the right knife to throw.
Mr. LeJudas.
Is that really how you feel now, Andy? That this is all a joke? Do you really have so little respect for what we do here?
Witness. When I said that to my wife, I assure you I wasn't joking. Let's leave it at that.
Mr. LeJudas.
All right. Continue with your story.
When we got back to our car in the garage, a block from the courthouse, there was a white piece of paper tucked under the windshield wiper. It was quarter folded. Opening it, I read, "Judgment Day is coming. Murderer, you die."
Jonathan was still with us, making it a group of four. He frowned at the note and slipped it into his briefcase.
"I'll take care of this. I'll file a report with the Cambridge police. You all go home."
Lori said, "That's all we can do?"
"We should let the Newton police know, too, just in case," I suggested. "Maybe it's time we had a cruiser camped out by our house. The world's full of lunatics."
I was distracted by a figure standing in the corner of the garage, quite a distance away, but obviously watching us. He was an older man, near 70, probably. He wore a jacket, golf shirt, and scally cap. He looked like a million guys around Boston. Some old Mick Tough. He was lighting a cigarette. It was the flare of his lighter that caught my eye. And the glowing tip of the cigarette linked him with the car that had been parked outside our house a few nights before, the interior blacked out except for the little glowing firefly of a cigarette tip in the car window. And wasn't he just the sort of dinosaur to drive a Lincoln frickin' town car? Our eyes met for a moment. He thrust his lighter into his pants pocket and continued walking, out through a doorway to a staircase, and he was gone. Had he been walking before I saw him? He seemed to have been standing and staring, but I had only just glanced over. Maybe he had just stopped a moment before to light the cigarette.
"Did you see that guy?"
Jonathan.
"What guy?"
"That guy who was just over there looking at us."
"Didn't see him. Who was he?"
"I don't know. Never seen him before."
"You think he had something to do with the note?"
"Don't know. I don't even know if he was looking at us. But he seemed to be, you know."
"Come on," Jonathan encouraged us toward the car. "There are a lot of people looking at us lately. It'll be over soon."
Chapter 31. Hanging Up. Around 6 that night, as the three of us finished our dinner, Jacob and I indulging ourselves in a little cautious optimism, spitting on LeJudas and his desperate tactics, Lori trying to keep up the appearance of confidence and normalcy, even as she had become vaguely suspicious of the both of us, the phone rang. I answered. An operator informed me that she had a collect call. Would I accept the charges? It came as a surprise that people still made collect calls. Was this a prank? Were there any phone booths left to make a collect call from?
Only in prisons.
Collect call from who?
Bill Barber.
Jesus, no, I won't accept. Wait a minute. Hang on. I held the phone against my chest as if my heart would speak to him directly. Then, all right, I'll accept the charges. Thank you. Please hold while I connect you. Have a nice day.
A click.
Hello?
What is it?
What is it? I thought she was going to come down and visit me again.
I've been a little busy.
He mimicked me.
Oh, I've been a little busy. Relax, would you? I'm just shitting you, you dope.
What'd you think? Hey, come on down, Junior. I'll take you out fishing.
I'll take you fishing. You know for what?
For fishes.
I had no idea what this meant. Some prison slang, presumably. Whatever it meant, the joke was funny to him. He roared into the phone.
Jesus Christ, you talk a lot.
No shit, 'cause I got no one to talk to in this fucking place. My kid never visits me.
Was there something you wanted, or did you just call to chat?
I want to know how the kid's trial is going.
What do you care?
He's my grandson, I want to know.
His whole life you never even knew his name.
Whose fault is that?
Yours?
Yeah, I'm sure you think that.
A pause.
I heard my name came up in court today. We're following the whole thing here. It's like the World Series for cons.
Yeah, your name came up. See, even sitting in prison, you're still screwing your family over.
Oh, Junior, don't be such a pisser. The kid's gonna get off.
You think so? You figure you're a pretty good lawyer, Mr. Life Without Parole?
I know a few things.
You know a few things.
Pfft. Do me a favor, Clarence Darrow. Don't call here and tell me my business. I've already got a lawyer.
Nobody's telling you your business, Junior, but when your lawyer talks about bringing me in to testify, that makes it my business now, don't it?
It isn't going to happen. That's all we need is you on the stand. Turn the whole thing into a circus.
You got a better strategy?
Yeah, we do.
What is it?
We're not even going to put on a case. We'll put the Commonwealth to its burden. They have...
What am I even talking to you about this for?
Because you want to, and the chips are down, a kid needs his old man.
Is that a joke?
No. I'm still your father.
No, you're not.
I'm not?
No.
Then who is?
Me.
You don't have a father? Where are you, a tree?
That's right, I don't have one, and I don't need one now.
Everybody needs a father. Everybody needs a father. You need me now more than ever.
How else are you going to prove that irresistible impulse thing?
We don't need to prove it.
No, why not?
Because LeJudas can't prove his case, that's obvious. So our defense is simple. Jacob didn't do it.
What if that changes?
It won't.
So why'd you come all the way down here and ask me about it?
And test my spit. What was that all about?
Just covering my bases.
Just covering your bases. So the kid didn't do it, but just in case he did.
Something like that.
So what's your lawyer want me to say then? He doesn't want you to say anything. He shouldn't have said that in court today. It was a mistake.
He was probably thinking he'd run you up there to testify that you never had anything to do with your grandson. But I already told you, you're not coming anywhere near that courtroom.
You better talk with your lawyer about that.
Listen to me, Bloody Billy. I'm going to say this for the last time. You don't exist. You're just a bad dream I used to have when I was a kid.
Hey, Junior, you want to hurt my feelings?
Kick me in the balls.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means don't bother calling me names. Don't bother me.
I'm the kid's grandfather no matter what you say. Nothing you can do about it.
You can deny me all you want. Pretend I don't exist. Doesn't matter. Doesn't change the truth.
I sat down, suddenly unsteady.
Who's this guy Pats your cop friend testified about?
I was pissed and confused, agitated, so I did not stop to consider. I blurted, he's the guy who did it.
That killed this kid?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yes.
How do you know?
I've got a witness.
And you're going to let my grandson take the hit for it?
Let him? No.
Then do something, Junior. Tell me about this guy, Pats.
What do you want to know? He likes little boys.
He's a child molester?
Sort of.
Sort of?
Either he is or he isn't.
How can you be sort of a child molester?
Same way you were a murderer before you actually murdered someone.
Oh, stop it, Junior. I told you, you can't hurt my feelings.
Would you stop calling me that, Junior?
Does it bother you?
Yes.
What should I call you?
Don't call me anything.
Psh, I got to call you something. How else am I going to talk to you?
You're not.
Junior, you got a lot of anger, you know that?
Was there anything else you wanted?
Wanted? I don't want anything out of you.
I figured maybe you want a cake with a file in it.
Funny guy, a file in it. I get it, 'cause I'm in prison.
That's right. Listen to me, Junior, I don't need no cake with a file in it, all right? You know why?
I'll tell you why.
'Cause I'm not in prison.
No, did they let you out?
They don't have to let me out.
They don't. Let me give you a tip, crazy old man. That big building with the bars, the one they never let you out of, that's called a prison, and you are definitely in it.
No, see now, you're the one that doesn't get it, Junior. All they got locked up in this hole is my body.
That's all they got, my body, not me.
I'm everywhere, see? Everywhere you look, Junior, everywhere you go, okay? Now you just keep my grandkid out of this place. You got that, Junior?
Why don't you do it? You're everywhere.
Maybe I will. Maybe I'll fly right up there.
Look, I gotta go, all right? I'm hanging up.
No, we're not done.
I hung up on him.
But he was right. He was right there with me, because his voice kept right on rattling in my ears. I picked the phone up and smashed it down in its cradle again, 1, 2, 3 times, until I could not hear him anymore. Jacob and Lori both were staring at me with wide eyes.
That was your grandfather.
I caught that.
Jake, I don't want you ever to talk to him, all right? I'm serious.
Okay.
You're never to speak with him, even if he calls you. You just hang up the phone, you got it?
Okay, okay.
Lori glared.
That goes for you too, Andy. I don't want that man calling my house. He's poison. Next time he calls, you hang up the phone, got it?
I nodded.
Are you all right, husband?
I don't know.
Chapter 32. The Absence of Evidence. Trial, Day 5. At the stroke of 9, Judge French stormed the bench and announced in a clenched way that the defendant's motion for mistrial was denied. He said, as the stenographer repeated his words into a cone-shaped microphone which she held over her face like an oxygen mask, "Defendant's objection to the mention of the defendant's grandfather is noted for the record, and the issue is preserved for appeal. I've given the jury a curative instruction. I think that's enough. The prosecutor is cautioned not to mention the issue any further, and that's all we're going to hear about it. Now, absent any other objections, court officer, bring in the jury and let's get started." I can't say I was surprised. Mistrials are rare. The judge was not going to flush away the state's enormous investment in seeing this trial through to the end, not if he could help it. He might have been embarrassed by a mistrial, too. It might look like he had lost control of his courtroom. LeJudas knew all this, of course. He may have crossed the line intentionally, betting that the high stakes in this case made a mistrial particularly unlikely. But that is unkind. The trial swept on. "What is your name, please?"
"Karen Rakowski, R-A-K-O-W-S-K-I.
"What is your occupation and your current assignment?"
"I'm a criminalist with the Massachusetts State Police. I'm currently assigned to the State Police Crime Lab."
"What is a criminalist exactly?"
"A criminalist is someone who applies the principles of the natural and physical sciences to identify, preserve, and analyze evidence at a crime scene. She later testifies to her findings in a court of law."
"How long have you been a criminalist with the state police?"
11 years.
"Approximately how many crime scenes would you say you've investigated over the course of your career?"
"Approximately 500.
"Are you a member of any professional organizations?" Rakowski proceeded to rattle off the names of a half dozen organizations, then her degrees and a teaching position and a few publications, all of which went swiftly by like a freight train.
difficult to distinguish in detail but impressive in its length. The truth was, no one listened to Rakowski's information dump because no one really questioned her qualifications. She was well-known and respected. It should be pointed out that the job of criminalist has become a lot more professional and rigorous than it was when I started out. It has even become fashionable. Forensic science has become a lot more complex, particularly with respect to DNA evidence. No doubt the job has been glamorized by shows like CSI, too. Whatever the reason, the job attracts more and better candidates now, and Karen Rakowski was among the first wave of criminalists in our country who were not just cops moonlighting as amateur scientists. She was the real thing. It was a lot easier to picture her in a white lab coat than in the jodhpurs and jackboots of the state police. I was glad she had been assigned the case. I knew she would give us a fair shake. On April 12, 2007, at around 10 a.m., did you get a phone call about a murder in Cold Spring Park in Newton? Yes, I did. What did you do in response? I went to the location where I was met by Lieutenant Duffy, who gave me a briefing about what he had at the crime scene and what he wanted me to do. He brought me to the location where the body was lying. Had the body been moved, as far as you know? I was told it had not been disturbed since the police arrived there. Had the medical examiner arrived yet? No. Is it preferable for the criminalist to arrive before the medical examiner? Yes. The ME can't process the body without moving it. Once the body is moved, obviously, you can't draw any inferences from its position. Now, in this case, you knew that the body had already been moved by the jogger who discovered it. I did. Were you able to draw any conclusions from the position of the body and from the surrounding scene nonetheless, when you first saw it? Yes. It was apparent that the attack had taken place at the top of the hill by a walking trail, and that the body had slid down the hill afterward. That was evidenced by a trail of blood leading down the hillside to the final resting position of the body. These are the contact smears of blood we heard about yesterday? Yes. When I arrived, the body itself had been rolled over face up, and I could see that the victim's T-shirt was soaked with what appeared to be wet blood. What significance did you attach, if any, to the large amount of blood on the victim's body? At the time, none. Obviously, the wounds were significant and fatal, but I knew that before I arrived. But doesn't the large amount of blood at the scene suggest a bloody struggle? Not necessarily. Blood circulates through our bodies constantly. It is a hydraulic system. It is being pumped around and around. It moves through the circulatory system, through the veins, under pressure. When a person is killed, the blood is no longer under the pressure of a pump, and its movement is then controlled by the ordinary laws of physics. So a lot of the blood that was apparent at the scene, both on the victim himself and on the ground underneath and around him, might have simply drained out of him because of gravity, because of the way the body was lying, feet above head, face down. So the blood on the body might have been post-mortem bleeding. I could not tell yet. Okay, so what did you do next? I examined the scene more closely. I observed some blood spatters near the top of the hill, at what seemed to be the point of the attack. There were only a few spatters here. Let me stop you there. Is there a discipline in the forensic sciences of blood spatter analysis? Yes, it is the study of the patterns of blood spatters, which can yield useful information. Were you able to get any useful information from the blood spatters in this case? Yes, as I was saying, at the point of attack, there were a few very small blood spatters, less than an inch in size, and it was apparent from their size that they had fallen more or less straight down to the ground, spattering evenly in all directions. This is called a low-velocity drop, or sometimes passive bleeding. LeJudas. Now, yesterday we heard some discussion by the defense about whether you could expect to find blood on the attacker's body or on his clothes after an attack like this one. Based on your observations of the blood spatters, do you have an opinion about this? Yes, it is not necessarily true that the attacker here would have blood on him. Going back to the circulatory system that pumps blood through the body, remember that once blood is ejected from the body out into the air, it is subject to the ordinary laws of physics, just like anything else. Now, it's true, if an artery is cut, depending on where it is on the body, you would expect the blood to gush out. That's called arterial gushing. Same with a vein. But if it's a capillary, you might see just dripping like this. I did not see any spatters at the scene that seemed to have been cast off with force. That sort of cast-off blood would land at an angle and spatter unevenly, like this.
She demonstrated by sliding her fist along the length of her forearm to show how the blood drop would spread across the surface at impact.
It is also possible that the assailant stood behind the victim when he stabbed him, which would put him out of the trajectory of any spraying blood. And, of course, it is possible the assailant changed his clothes after the attack, all of which is simply to say that you cannot automatically assume that the assailant in this case would be covered in blood after the attack, despite the large amount of blood found at the scene.
Are you familiar with the saying, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence?
Objection. Leading.
He can have it. You can answer the question.
Yes. What does that saying mean? It means that just because there is no physical evidence proving a person's presence at a particular time and place, you cannot necessarily conclude that he was not actually there. It's probably easier to understand if I put it this way. A person can be present at a crime and leave no physical evidence there.
Rakowski's testimony went on for some time. It was a critical part of LaJudice's case, and he took his time putting it in. She testified in detail that the blood found at the scene was all the victim's. There was no physical evidence found in the immediate vicinity of the body that could be linked to any other person. No finger, hand, or shoe prints, no hairs or fibers, no blood or other organic material, with the single exception of that damn fingerprint.
Where precisely was the fingerprint located?
The victim was wearing a zippered sweatshirt with the zipper open. On the inside of that sweatshirt, about here, she indicated a spot on the inside of her own jacket, on the left side of the lining where an interior pocket is often located, there was a plastic tag with the manufacturer's name. The print was found on that tag.
Does the surface on which a fingerprint is found affect its value?
Well, some surfaces take a print better. This was a flat surface. It had been wetted with blood, almost like an inked pad, and it showed the fingerprint very clearly.
So this was a clean print?
Yes.
And after studying this fingerprint, whose print did you determine it was?
The defendant, Jacob Barber's.
Jonathan stood and said with a shrug in his voice, "We'll stipulate it's the defendant's fingerprint."
The judge said, "Without objection," and he turned to the jury. "The meaning of a stipulation is that the defense concedes that a fact is true without the prosecutor having to prove it. Both parties agree to the truth of this fact, therefore you may take it as true and proven."
"Okay, Mr. LaJudice."
"What significance, if any, did you assign to the fact that the fingerprint was in the victim's own blood?"
"Obviously, the blood had to be on that tag first in order for the defendant's finger to be pressed into it.
So the significance is that the fingerprint was put there after the attack had begun, or at least after the victim had been cut at least once, and soon enough after the attack, that the blood on that tag was still wet, since dry blood would not have taken the print the same way, if at all. So that print was put there during or very soon after the attack."
"How big a window are we talking about? How soon before the blood on that tag is too dry to take the fingerprint?"
"There are a lot of factors involved, but not more than 15 minutes on the outside."
"Even sooner, is it likely?"
"Impossible to say."
"Good girl, Karen. Don't take the bait."
"The only sparring took place when LaJudice tried to enter into evidence a knife, a sleek and wicked thing called a Spyderco civilian, which was the knife Jacob specifically named in his story imagining the Rifkin murder. Jonathan vehemently objected to this knife being shown to the jury since there was no evidence that Jacob ever owned such a knife. I had dumped Jacob's knife long before the cops searched his room, but I blanched at the sight of the Spyderco civilian. It looked very similar to Jacob's. I didn't dare turn around to look at Lori, so I can only report what she later told me. I died when I saw it." Judge French ultimately did not allow LaJudice to enter the knife in evidence. Its physical appearance, he said, was inflammatory, given how weakly the government had linked the knife to Jacob, which was Judge French's way of saying he was not about to let LaJudice start waving a lethal-looking knife around the courtroom as a way to work the jury up into a lynch mob, not until the government offered a witness who could say Jacob had such a knife. But he would allow the expert to testify about the knife in general terms.
"Is that knife consistent with the victim's wounds?" Yes, we examined the size and shape of the blade relative to the wounds, and they were consistent. The blade on that particular knife is curved and has a serrated edge, which would account for the ragged tears at the edge of the wounds. It is a knife designed for slashing at an opponent as you would in a knife fight. A knife intended to make a neat slice will typically have a smooth, very sharp edge, like a scalpel.
So the killer might have used exactly that sort of knife?
Objection. Overruled.
He might have, yes.
Could you tell from the angle of the wounds and the design of the knife how the killer might have inflicted the fatal wounds, what sort of motion he might have used?
Based on the fact that the wounds enter the body essentially straight, that is, on a horizontal plane, it would seem that the assailant most likely stood directly in front of the victim, was of about equal height, and stabbed straight ahead in three thrusts, holding his arm roughly level.
Would you demonstrate the motion you mean, please?
Objection.
Overruled.
Rakowski stood up and thrust her right arm ahead three times. She sat back down.
Lejudas said nothing for a few seconds. The courtroom was silent enough in those moments that I heard someone behind me in the gallery emit a long breath.
Whew.
Jonathan fought gallantly on cross. He did not attack Rakowski directly. She was obviously competent and playing it straight, and there was nothing to be gained by savaging her. He kept the focus on the physical evidence and how thin it really was.
The government mentioned the phrase, "the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence." Do you remember that?
Yes.
Isn't it also true that the absence of evidence is precisely that? An absence of evidence?
Yes.
Jonathan showed a wry smile to the jury.
In this case, we have a fairly substantial absence of evidence, don't we? There is no blood evidence against the defendant?
No.
Genetic evidence? DNA?
No.
Hairs?
No.
Fibers?
No.
Anything at all that puts the defendant at the scene besides that fingerprint?
No.
Handprints, fingerprints, shoe prints, all missing?
That's true.
Well, now that's what I call an absence of evidence.
The jury laughed. Jacob and I laughed, more with relief than anything else.
Lejudas jumped up to object, and the objection was sustained, but it hardly mattered.
And the fingerprint that was found, Jacob's fingerprint on the victim's sweatshirt. Isn't it true that fingerprint evidence has one huge limitation? You can't tell when the print was put there?
That's true, except for the inference to be drawn from the fact the blood was still wet when the defendant's finger touched it.
Yes, the wet blood. Exactly. May I pose a hypothetical to you, Ms. Rakowski? Let's suppose, hypothetically, that the defendant, Jacob, came upon the victim, his friend and classmate, lying on the ground in the park as he, Jacob, walked to school. Suppose, again for our hypothetical, suppose it was only minutes after the attack, and suppose, finally, that he held the victim by his sweatshirt in an attempt to help him or to be sure he was okay. Wouldn't that be perfectly consistent with finding the fingerprint where you did?
Yes.
And finally, with regard to the knife we heard about, the Spyderco civilian. Isn't it true that there are many knives that could have created those wounds?
Yes, I presume so.
Because all you have to judge by is the characteristics of those wounds, the size and shape, the depth of penetration, and so on. Isn't that right?
Yes.
And all you know, therefore, is that the murder weapon seemed to have a jagged edge and a blade of a certain size. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Did you make any effort to determine how many knives out there fit that description?
No, I was asked by the DA only to determine whether that particular knife was consistent with the victim's wounds. I was not given any other knives to compare.
Well, that's putting the rabbit into the hat then, isn't it?
Objection.
Sustained.
The investigators made no effort to determine how many knives could have made those wounds.
I was not asked about other models, no.
Do you have any idea, roughly, how many knives would leave a wound about 2 inches wide and penetrate 3 or 4 inches?
I don't know. I would be speculating.
1,000? Come on, it must be at least that many.
I couldn't say. It would be a large number.
You have to remember, a small knife can create an opening larger than the blade itself because the attacker can use it to slice the wound open. A scalpel is quite small, but obviously it can create a very large incision. So when we talk about the size of the wound relative to the blade, what we're talking about is the maximum size of the blade, the outer limit, because obviously the blade cannot be larger than the opening it was inserted into, at least if we're talking about a penetration wound as we are here. Below that limit, the size of the wound alone cannot tell you precisely how big the knife was, so I can't answer your question.
Jonathan cocked his head. He was not buying it.
500? I don't know.
100?
It's possible.
Ah, it's possible. So our chances are 1 in 100.
Objection.
Sustained.
Why were the investigators interested in that particular knife, Ms. Rakowski, the Spyderco civilian? Why did they ask you to compare that model with the wounds?
Because it was mentioned in an account of the murder that the defendant wrote, according to Derek Yu.
Correct. And the same witness apparently saw a similar knife in the defendant's possession.
Derek Yu again?
I believe so.
So the only thing connecting that knife to Jacob is this one mixed-up boy, Derek Yu?
She did not answer. LeJudas objected too quickly. It did not matter.
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Chapter 33. Father O'Leary. The case was becoming a close thing, it seemed to me, but I still felt optimistic. LeJudas was hoping to draw an inside straight, to assemble a winning combination out of a messy hand of deuce 3-5-6. He had no choice, really. He had crap cards. No ace, no piece of evidence so damning it required the jury to convict. His last hope was a cohort of witnesses culled from Jacob's classmates. I could not imagine any of the McCormick kids commanding that much respect from the jury. Jacob felt as I did, and we had a fine old time ridiculing LeJudas's case, reassuring ourselves that every card he laid down was a deuce or a three. Jonathan's bit about the absence of evidence and the dressing down LeJudas got for alluding to the murder gene issue particularly delighted us. I do not mean to suggest Jacob was not scared shitless. He was. We all were. Jacob's anxiety just took the form of beating his chest a little. Mine, too. I felt aggressive, all adrenaline and testosterone. I was a fast idling engine. The nearness of such an enormous catastrophe as a guilty verdict sharpened every sensation. Lori was a lot more gloomy. She assumed that in a close case the jury would feel it was their duty to convict. They would take no chances, just lock up this boy monster, protect everyone else's innocent babes, and be done with it. She also figured the jury would want to see someone swing for the murder of Ben Rifkin. Anything less, and justice would not have been done. If the neck in the noose happened to be Jacob's, they would take it. In all Lori's doomsaying, I heard intimations of something darker, but I did not dare challenge her on it. Some feelings it is better not to surface. Some things a mother should never be forced to say about her son, even if she believes them. So we declared a truce that night. We resolved to stop the endless rehashing of the forensic testimony we had heard that day. No more talk about the nuances of blood spatters and angles of knife entry and all that. Instead, we sat on the couch and watched TV in contented silence. When Lori went upstairs around 10, I had a vague idea that I might follow her. Once I would have. My libido would have pulled me up the stairs like a Great Dane on a leash. But that was over now. Lori's interest in sex had vanished, and I could not imagine going to sleep beside her or going to sleep at all. Anyway, someone needed to turn off the TV and tell Jacob to go to bed when the time came, otherwise the kid would be up until 2. Just after 11, John Stewart was just coming on. Jake said, "He's here again."
"Who?"
"The guy with the cigarette." I peered through the wood shutters in our living room. Across the street was the Lincoln Town Car. It was parked, brazenly, right across the street from our house under a streetlight. The window was open a crack so the driver could flick his cigarette ashes out onto the street. Jacob said, "Should we call the cops?"
"No, I'll take care of it myself."
I went to the coat closet in the front hall and rummaged out a baseball bat that had been there for years, stuck in among the umbrellas and boots where Jacob must have left it after Little League one day. It was aluminum, red, a kid-sized Louisville slugger.
"Maybe this isn't such a good idea, Dad."
"It's a fantastic idea, trust me." I concede, looking back, that this was, in fact, not a fantastic idea. I was not unaware of the harm I could do to the public's perception of us, even of Jacob. I think I had some vague notion I would throw a scare into Cigarette Man without doing any real harm. More to the point, I felt like I could run through a wall, and I wanted to do something, finally. I'm not sure how far I meant to take it, honestly. In the event, I never got the chance to find out. As I reached the sidewalk in front of my own house, an unmarked police cruiser, a black interceptor, raced up between us. It seemed to come out of nowhere, its wigwags and blue flashers lighting up the street. The cruiser parked at an angle to the front of the Lincoln, blocking it from leaving. Out popped Paul Duffy, in plain clothes except for a state police windbreaker and a badge clipped to his belt. He looked at me. I think by now I had dropped the bat to my side at least, though I must have looked ridiculous anyway. And he raised his eyebrows. "Get back in the house, Babe Ruth." I did not move. I was so shocked, and my feelings about Duffy were so mixed at this point that I could not really listen to him anyway. Duffy ignored me and went to the Lincoln. The driver's window opened with an electric hum, and the driver asked, "Is there a problem?" "License and registration, please." "What did I do?" "License and registration, please." "I have a right to sit in my car, don't I?" "Sir, are you refusing to provide identification?" "I'm not refusing anything. I just want to know what you're bothering me for. I'm just sitting here minding my own business in a public street." The driver relented, though. He popped his cigarette into his mouth and leaned far over so he could wiggle his wallet out from under his ass. When Duffy took the license and went back to the cruiser, the guy looked at me from under the brim of his scally cap and said, "How you doing, pal?" I did not answer. "Everything okay with you and your family?" More staring. "It's good to have a family." I did not answer again, and the guy went back to smoking his cigarette with theatrical nonchalance. Duffy came out of the cruiser again and handed the guy his license and registration. "Duffy, were you parked here the other night?" "No, sir, I don't know anything about that." "Why don't you move on, Mr. O'Leary? Have a good night. Don't come back here again." "It's a public street, isn't it?" "Not for you." "All right, officer." He leaned way over again and grunted as he wedged his wallet into his back pocket. "Sorry, I move a little slow. Getting old. Happens to everyone, right?" He grinned up at Duffy, then at me. "You gentlemen have a nice evening." He pulled his seatbelt across his chest and made a show of clicking it. "Click it or ticket," he said. "Officer, I'm afraid you'll have to move your car. You're blocking me." Duffy went to his cruiser and backed it up a few feet. "Good night, Mr. Barber," the man said, and he cruised off slowly. Duffy came up to stand beside me. I said, "You want to tell me what that was all about?" "I think we better talk." "You want to come in?" "Look, Andy, I understand if you don't want to have me around in the house, whatever, it's okay, we can just talk here." "No, it's all right, just come in." "I'd rather..." I said, "It's okay, Duff." He frowned. "Is Lori up?" "You afraid to face her?" "Yes." "But you're not afraid to face me." "I'm not thrilled about it, to be honest." "Well, don't worry, I think she's asleep." "You mind if I take that?" I handed him the bat. "Were you really going to use it?" "I have the right to remain silent." "Probably a good time to do that." He tossed the bat into his cruiser and followed me inside. Lori stood at the top of the stairs in flannel pajama bottoms and a sweatshirt with her arms crossed. She said nothing. Duffy said, "Hi, Lori." She turned away, went back to bed. "Hi, Jacob." "Hi," Jacob said, constrained by manners and habit from expressing any sense of anger or betrayal. In the kitchen, I asked what he had been doing outside our house. "Your lawyer called me. He said he wasn't getting any traction in Newton or Cambridge." "So he called you? I thought you were in public relations now." "Yeah, well, I did this as kind of a personal project." I nodded. I don't know how I felt about Paul Duffy at that moment. I suppose I understood that he did what he had to do in testifying against Jacob. I could not think of him as my enemy. But we would never be friends again either. If my kid wound up in Walpole doing life without parole, it would be Duffy who put him there.
We both knew that. Neither of us had the words to address any of this directly, so we ignored it. This is the best thing about men's friendships. Most any awkwardness can be ignored by mutual agreement, and true connection being unimaginable, you can get on with the easier business of parallel living. So who is he? His name is James O'Leary. They call him Father O'Leary. Born February 1943, so 64 years old. Grandfather O'Leary, more like. He's no joke. He's an old gangster. His record goes back 50 years and it reads like a statute book. It's all there. Weapons, drugs, violence. The feds had him up on a RICO charge with a bunch of other guys back in the 80s, but he beat it. He used to be a muscle guy, that's what I was told. A leg breaker. Now he's too old for that. So what does he do now? He's a fixer. Hires himself out, but it's just small-time stuff. He makes problems go away. Whatever you need, collections, evictions, shutting people up. Father O'Leary. So what's he got against Jacob? Nothing, I'm sure. The question is, who is paying him and for what? And? Duffy shrugged. I have no idea. Must be somebody who's got a beef with Jacob. That's a big group at the moment. Anybody who knew Ben Rifkin? Anybody who's ticked off about this case? Hell, anybody with basic cable. Great. So what do I do if I see him again? Cross the street, then call me. You'll send the public relations department? I'll send the 82nd Airborne if I have to. I smiled. I still got a few friends, he assured me. Are they going to let you go back to CPAC? Depends. We'll see if Rasputin lets them when he becomes DA. He still needs one big hook before he runs for DA. Yeah, that's the other thing. He's not going to get it. No? No. I've been looking into your friend Pat's. Because you got crossed on it? That, and I remember you asking about Pat's and LaJudas and whether there was any connection between them. Why would LaJudas not want to look at him for this murder? And? Well, maybe it's nothing, but there is a connection there. LaJudas had a case with him when he was in the child abuse unit. It was a rape. LaJudas broke it down to indecent A and B and pleaded it out. So? It might be nothing. Maybe the victim was reluctant or could not go through with it for whatever reason, and LaJudas did the right thing. Or maybe he dumped the wrong case and Pats went off and committed a murder. Not the kind of thing you put on a campaign poster. He shrugged. I don't have access to the DA's files. That's as far as I could get without calling attention to what I was doing. Hey, it's not much, but it's something. Thanks. Yeah, we'll see, he murmured. It kind of doesn't matter if it's true, does it? If you just mention something like that in court, kick up a little dust in people's eyes, know what I mean? Yeah, I know what you mean, Perry Mason. And if LaJudas takes it on the chin, that's just a bonus, right? I smiled. Yeah. Andy, I am sorry, you know. I know you are. This job sucks sometimes. We stood looking at each other for a few seconds. All right, he said. Well, I'll let you get to sleep. Big day tomorrow. You want me to sit out there a while in case your friend comes back? No, thanks. We'll be okay, I think. Okay, so see you later, I guess. Before I got into bed 20 minutes later, I raised the bedroom shade to peek out at the street. The black cruiser was still there, as I knew it would be. Chapter 34. Jacob was mad. Trial Day 6. Father O'Leary was in the audience at the back of the courtroom when the trial resumed next morning. Lori, looking gray and depleted, was at her lonely post in the front row of the gallery. LaJudas, his confidence buoyed by the performances of a series of professional witnesses, moved with a little strut. It is a peculiarity of trials that, though the witness is ostensibly the star, the lawyer who is asking the questions is the only one in the courtroom who is free to move around as he pleases. Good lawyers tend not to move much, since they want the juror's eyes to remain on the witness. But LaJudas could not seem to find a comfortable perch as he flitted from the witness stand to the jury box to the prosecution table and various points in between before finally coming to roost at the lectern. I suspect he was on edge about the day's slate of civilian witnesses, Jacob's classmates, determined not to let these amateur witnesses run away with his case the way the last ones had.
On the stand was Derek Yu. Derek, who had eaten in our kitchen 1,000 times, who had lounged on our couch watching football games and scattering Doritos on the carpet. Derek, who had jumped around the living room playing GameCube and Wii with Jacob. Derek, who had blissfully nodded his head for hours, probably stoned, to the pounding bass beat of his iPod while Jacob did the same beside him, the music so loud we could hear it murmuring in his headphones. It was like hearing their thoughts. Now, seeing the same Derek Yu on the stand, I would happily have skinned him alive with his limp, brush-proof garage band hair and sleepy slacker expression, who now threatened to send my son to Walpole forever. For the event, Derek wore a tweed sport coat that hung off his narrow shoulders. His shirt collar was too big. Cinched under his tie, it bunched and twisted and dangled from his skinny neck like a waiting noose.
"How long have you known the defendant, Derek?"
"Since kindergarten, I guess."
"You went to elementary school together?"
"Yes."
"Where was that?"
"Mason Rice in Newton."
"And you've been friendly ever since?"
"Yes."
"Best friends?"
"I guess so, sometimes."
"You've been to each other's houses?"
"Yeah."
"Hung out together after school and on weekends?"
"Yeah."
"Have you been in the same home room?"
"Sometimes."
"When was the last time?"
"Not last year. This year Jake is not in school. I guess he has a tutor. So, I guess 2 years ago."
"But even in years when you weren't in the same home room, you remained close friends?"
"Yeah."
"So, how many years is it that you and the defendant have been close friends?"
8.
"8. And you're how old?"
"I'm 15 now."
"Is it fair to say that, as of the day Ben Rifkin was murdered, April 12, 2007, Jacob Barber was your best friend?" Derek's voice went quiet. The thought made him either sad or embarrassed.
"Yeah."
"Okay. Directing your attention to the morning of April 12, 2007, do you remember where you were that morning?"
"In school."
"About what time did you get to school?"
8:30.
"How did you get to school that day?"
"Walked."
"Did your route take you through Cold Spring Park?"
"No, I come from the other direction."
"Okay. When you got to school, where did you go?"
"I stopped at my locker to put my stuff away, then I went to homeroom."
"And the defendant was not in your homeroom that year, correct?"
"Yes."
"Did you see him before homeroom that morning?"
"Yeah, I saw him at the lockers."
"What was he doing?"
"He was just putting his stuff in his locker."
"Was there anything unusual about his appearance?"
"No."
"About his clothes?"
"No."
"Was there anything on his hand?"
"There was a big spot. It looked like blood."
"Describe the spot."
"It was just like a red spot, like the size of a quarter."
"Did you ask him about it?"
"Yes. I said, 'Dude, what did you do to your hand?' And he was like, 'Oh, it's nothing, just a scratch.'"
"Did you see the defendant try to remove the blood?"
"Not right then."
"Did he deny that the spot on his hand was blood?"
"No."
"Okay, what happened next?"
"I went off to homeroom."
"Was Ben Rifkin in your homeroom that year?"
"Yes."
"But he wasn't in homeroom that morning?"
"No."
"Did that seem strange to you?"
"No, I don't know if I even noticed. I guess I would have figured he was just out sick."
"So what happened in homeroom?"
"Nothing, just the usual, attendance, some announcements, then we went off to class."
"What was your first class that day?"
"English."
"Did you go?"
"Yeah."
"Was the defendant in your English class?"
"Yeah."
"Did you see him in the classroom that morning?"
"Yes."
"Did you speak to him?"
"We just said hello, that's all."
"Was there anything unusual about the defendant's manner or anything he said?"
"No, not really."
"He didn't seem upset?"
"No."
"Anything unusual about his appearance?"
"No."
"No blood on his clothes, nothing like that?"
"Objection."
"Sustained."
"Would you describe the defendant's appearance when you saw him in English class that morning?"
"I think he was just wearing, like, regular clothes. Jeans, sneakers, whatever. There was no blood on his clothes, if that's what you mean."
"What about on his hands?"
"The spot was gone."
"He'd washed his hands?"
"I guess."
"Were there any cuts or scratches on his hands? Any reason he might have been bleeding?"
Not that I remember. I wasn't really paying attention. It didn't matter then.
Okay, what happened next?
We had English class for like 15 minutes. Then there was an announcement that the school was being put in a lockdown.
What is a lockdown?
It's when you have to go back to your home room and they take attendance and lock all the doors and keep everyone there.
Do you know why the school gets put in a lockdown?
Because there's some kind of danger.
What did you think when you heard the school was going into a lockdown?
Columbine.
You thought somebody was at the school with a gun?
Yeah.
Did you have any idea who?
No.
Were you afraid?
Yeah, of course, everybody was.
Do you remember how the defendant reacted when the principal announced the lockdown?
He didn't say anything. He just kind of smiled. There wasn't much time. We just heard it and everybody ran.
Did the defendant seem nervous or frightened?
No.
At the time, did anybody know what the lockdown was about?
No.
Did anyone connect it to Ben Rifkin?
No. I mean, later that morning they told us, but not at the start.
What happened next?
We just stayed in our home rooms with the doors locked. They came on the intercom and they told us we weren't in any danger. There were no guns or anything. So the teachers unlocked the door and we just kind of waited there. It was like a drill or something.
You had practiced lockdowns before?
Yeah.
What happened next?
We stayed there. They told us to take out our books and read or do homework or whatever. Then they canceled school for the rest of the day and we went home around 11.
Nobody ever questioned you or the other students?
Not that day, no.
Nobody ever searched the school or the lockers or any of the students?
Not that I saw.
So, when school got out and they finally let you leave the room, what did you see?
There were just a lot of parents waiting outside the school to get their kids. All the parents came to the school.
When did you see the defendant next?
We were texting that afternoon, I guess.
By texting, you mean you were exchanging text messages on your cell phones?
Yes.
What did you talk about?
Well, at that point, all we knew was that Ben got killed. We didn't know, like, exactly what happened or anything, so we were just both like, did you hear anything? What did you hear? What's going on?
And what did the defendant say to you?
Well, I was just like, dude, isn't that the way you go to school? Did you see anything? And Jake just said no.
He said no?
That's right.
He didn't say that he'd seen Ben lying on the ground and he tried to revive him or see if he was okay?
No.
What else did he say while you were texting?
Well, we were just kind of joking because Ben had been kind of picking on Jacob for a while, so we were all like, couldn't happen to a nicer guy and your wishes came true and stuff like that.
I know that sounds really bad now, but it was just like joking. When you say Ben Rifkin had been picking on Jacob, describe what you mean. What exactly had been going on between those two?
Ben was just like, he was in a different group. He was just, I don't want to say not nice things about him after what happened and everything, but he was not very nice to Jake or to me or to anyone in our group.
Who was in your group?
It was pretty much me, Jake, and this other kid, Dylan.
And what was your group like? What was your reputation in school?
We were geeks.
Derek said this without embarrassment or bitterness. Did not bother him, just the way it was.
And Ben, what was he like?
Well, I don't know. He was handsome.
He was handsome?
Derek flushed.
I don't know. He was just in a different group than us.
Were you friends with Ben Rifkin?
No. I mean, I knew him, like, to say hello, but we weren't friends.
But he never picked on you.
I don't know. He probably called me a fag or whatever. I wouldn't call it bullying or anything. Somebody calls you a fag, it's just like, whatever, it was no big deal.
Did Ben call other people names?
Yes.
Like what?
I don't know, fag, geek, slut, bitch, loser, whatever. It was just the way he was. It was kind of the way he talked.
To everyone?
No, not everyone, just kids he didn't like, kids he didn't think were cool.
Was Jacob cool?
Shy smile.
No, none of us were.
Did Ben like Jacob?
No, definitely not.
Why not?
Just didn't.
For no reason? Was there some kind of beef between them? Anything specific?
No, it was just like Ben didn't think Jake was cool. None of us were. He said stuff to all of us.
But it was worse for Jacob than for you or Dylan.
Yes.
Why? I think he just kind of saw that it got to Jake. Like I said, for me, if somebody calls you a fag or a geek or whatever, what can you do? I just kind of didn't fight back. But Jake got all bent out of shape, so Ben just kept on doing it.
Doing what?
Calling him names.
What names?
Fag, mostly. Some other things. Worse things.
What worse things?
Go ahead, you can say them.
It was mostly about being gay. He would keep asking Jacob whether he'd done different gay stuff. He just kept saying it over and over and over.
Saying what?
Derek took a deep breath.
I don't know if I can use the words.
It's all right, go ahead.
He'd say, like, did you suck anyone's... I don't really want to say it. It was just stuff like that. He just wouldn't stop.
Did anyone at school think Jacob actually was gay?
Objection. Overruled.
No, I mean, I don't think so. It's not like anyone cared anyway. I don't care.
He looked at Jacob.
I still don't care.
Did Jacob ever say anything to you about being gay either way?
He said he wasn't.
In what context? Why did he say that to you?
I was just like telling him to ignore Ben. I was like, hey, Jake, it's not like you're gay anyway, so what do you care? So he said he wasn't, and he said it wasn't about whether he was gay. It was about Ben giving him shit. Giving him grief, I mean. And how long it was going to go on before anyone did anything to stop it. He just knew it was wrong, and no one was doing anything to stop it.
So Jacob was upset about it.
Yes.
He felt he was being bullied.
He was being bullied.
Did you ever intervene to try to stop Ben from bullying your friend?
No.
Why not?
Because it wouldn't have mattered. Ben wouldn't have listened. It doesn't work that way.
Was the bullying just verbal, or did it ever become physical?
Sometimes Ben would push him or, like, jostle him as he went by, like knock him with his shoulder. Sometimes he took Jake's stuff, like stuff from his backpack or his lunch or whatever.
Now, the defendant looks like a big kid. How could Ben get away with picking on him?
Ben was big, too, and he was kind of tougher. And he had more friends. I think we all, like Jake and Dylan and me, we kind of knew we weren't important kids. I mean, I don't know, it's weird. It's kind of hard to explain. But if it got to be a real fight with Ben, we would have just been cut out.
Socially, you mean?
Yeah. And then what would school be like if we were just, like, alone?
Did Ben do this to other kids, too? Or just Jacob?
Just Jacob.
Any idea why?
'Cause he knew it made Jake mad.
You could see it made him mad?
Everyone could.
Did Jacob get mad a lot?
At Ben, of course.
At other things, too?
Yeah, a little.
Tell us about Jacob's temper.
Objection. Overruled.
Go ahead, Derek. Tell us about the defendant's temper.
He just, like, he got really upset about stuff. He kind of stewed about it, and he couldn't let it go. He'd get himself all worked up on the inside, and then sometimes he would kind of go off over some little thing. He'd always feel bad afterward, and he'd be embarrassed because it was like he was always overreacting, because it was never just about whatever made him go off. It was all the other stuff he'd be thinking about.
And you know this how?
Because he'd tell me.
Did he ever lose his temper with you?
No.
Did he ever lose his temper in front of you?
Yeah, sometimes he could be a little schizo.
Objection. Sustained. The jury will ignore that last comment.
Derek, would you describe a time you saw the defendant lose his temper?
Objection. Relevance. Sustained.
Derek, would you tell the court what happened when the defendant found a stray dog?
Objection. Relevance. Sustained. Move on, Mr. LeJudas.
LeJudas puckered his mouth. He flipped a page of his yellow pad, a page of questions he would set aside. Like a bird rustled from his perch, he began to move nervously around the courtroom again as he asked his questions until, at length, he settled back into his place at the lectern near the jury box.
For whatever reason, in the days after Ben Rifkin's murder, you became concerned about your friend Jacob's role in it?
Objection. Overruled.
You can answer, Derek.
Yes.
Was there anything in particular besides his temper that made you suspicious of Jacob?
Yes, he had a knife. It was like kind of an army knife, like a combat knife. It had this really, really sharp blade with all these teeth. It was a really scary knife.
You saw this knife yourself?
Yeah, Jake showed it to me. He even brought it to school once.
Why did he bring it to school?
Objection.
Sustained.
Did he show you the knife once at school?
Yeah, he showed me.
Did he say why he was showing it to you?
No.
Did he tell you why he wanted a knife at all?
I think he just thought it was cool.
And how did you react when you saw the knife?
I was like, dude, that's cool.
You weren't bothered by it?
No.
Concerned?
No, not then.
Was Ben Rifkin around when Jacob produced the knife that day?
No, nobody knew Jake had the knife. That's the thing, he was just walking around with it. It was like Jake had this secret.
Where did he carry the knife?
In his backpack or his pocket.
Did he ever show it to anyone else or threaten anyone with it?
No.
All right, so Jacob had a knife. Was there anything else that made you suspicious of your friend Jacob in the hours and days after Ben Rifkin was murdered?
Well, like I said, at the very beginning, nobody knew what happened. And then it kind of came out that Ben got killed with a knife in Cold Spring Park, and I just kind of knew.
Knew what?
Knew, I mean, I felt like he probably did it.
Objection.
Sustained.
The jury will disregard the last answer.
How did you know Jacob?
Objection.
Sustained. Move on, Mr. LeJudas.
LeJudas pursed his lips, regrouped.
Did Jacob ever talk about a website called The Cutting Room?
Yes.
Would you tell the jury what is The Cutting Room?
It's like a porn site, kind of, only it's just stories and anyone can write stories and post them there.
What kind of stories?
Like S&M, I guess. I don't really know. It's like sex and violence.
Did Jacob talk about the site often?
Yeah, he liked it, I guess. He used to go there a lot.
Did you go there?
Sheepish, blushing.
No, I didn't like it.
Did it bother you that Jacob went there?
No, it's his business.
Did Jacob ever show you a story on The Cutting Room that described Ben Rifkin's murder?
Yes.
When did Jacob show you this story?
Like late April, I think.
After the murder?
Yeah, a few days after.
What did he tell you about it?
He just said he had this story he wrote and he posted it on this message board.
You mean he posted it online for other people to read?
Yeah.
And did you read the story?
Yes.
How did you find it?
Jacob sent me a link.
How? Email? Facebook?
Facebook? No. Anyone could have seen it. I think it was email. So I went to the site and I read it.
And what did you think of the story when you read it the first time?
I don't know. I thought it was weird that he wrote it, but it was kind of interesting, I guess. Jacob was always a really good writer.
Did he write other stories like this one?
No, not exactly. He wrote some that were like,
objection,
sustained,
next question.
LeJudas produced a document, laser-printed, thick with text on both sides. He laid it on the witness stand in front of Derek.
Is that the story the defendant told you he wrote?
Yes.
Is that printout an accurate record of the story precisely as you read it that day?
Yeah, I guess.
Move the document be admitted in evidence.
The document is admitted and marked Commonwealth's Exhibit... Mary?
26.
Commonwealth's Exhibit 26.
How do you know for sure that the defendant wrote this story?
Why would he say it if it wasn't true?
And what was it about the story that made you so concerned about Jacob and the Rifkin murder?
It was just like a total description in every little detail. He described the knife, the stabs in the chest, the whole thing. Even the character, the kid that got stabbed. In the story, Jake calls him Brent Malice, but it's obviously Ben Rifkin. Anyone who knew Ben would know. It wasn't like totally fiction, it was just obvious.
Do you and your friends sometimes exchange messages on Facebook?
Sure.
And 3 days after Ben Rifkin was murdered, on April 15th, 2007, did you post a message on Facebook saying, Jake, everyone knows you did it. You have a knife. I've seen it.
Yes.
Why did you post that message?
I just didn't want to be the only one who knew about the knife. It was like I didn't want to be alone knowing that. When you posted that message on Facebook accusing your friend of the murder, did he ever respond?
I wasn't really accusing him. It was just something I wanted to say.
Did the defendant respond in any way?
I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, he posted on Facebook, but not really responding to that.
Well, did he ever deny that he murdered Ben Rifkin?
No.
After you published your accusation on Facebook in front of his whole class?
I didn't publish it. I just put it on Facebook.
Did he ever deny the accusation?
No.
Did you ever accuse him directly to his face?
No.
Before you saw that story on The Cutting Room, did you ever report your suspicions about Jacob to the police?
Not exactly.
Why not?
Because I wasn't totally sure. Plus, the cop in charge of the case was Jacob's dad.
And what did you think when you realized that it was Jacob's dad who was running the case?
Objection.
Jonathan's voice was disgusted. Sustained.
Derek, one last question. It was you that sought out the police to share this information, isn't that right?
Nobody had to come ask you?
That's right.
You felt you had to turn in your own best friend?
Yeah.
No further questions. Jonathan stood up. He seemed for all the world to be unfazed by what he had just heard, and he would conduct a gallant cross, I knew. But something had obviously changed in the courtroom. The atmosphere was electric. It was as if we had all just decided something. You could read it in the faces of the jurors and Judge French. You could hear it in the supreme quiet of the crowd. Jacob was not going to walk out of that courtroom. Not out the front door, anyway. The excitement was a mix of relief. Everyone's doubts were resolved at last about whether Jacob did it and whether he would get away with it, and palpable eagerness for revenge. The rest of the trial would only be details, formalities, tying up loose ends. Even my friend Ernie, the court officer, looked at Jacob with a wary eye, assessing how he would react to the handcuffs. But Jonathan seemed not to notice the drop in air pressure. He moved to the lectern and slipped on the half glasses he wore on a chain around his neck and began to take it apart piece by piece.
These things you've told us about, they bothered you, but not so much that you broke off your friendship with Jacob.
No.
In fact, you two continued to be friends for days and even weeks after the murder, isn't that right?
Yes.
Isn't it true that you even went to Jacob's house after the murder?
Yes.
So it's fair to say that you weren't too sure at the time that Jacob really was the murderer.
Yeah, that's right.
Because you wouldn't want to remain friends with a murderer, of course.
No, I guess not.
Even after you posted that message on Facebook where you accused Jacob of the murder, you still remained friends with him. You still remained in contact, still hung around?
Yes.
Were you ever afraid of Jacob?
No.
Did he ever threaten or intimidate you in any way, or lose his temper at you?
No.
Isn't it true that it was your parents who told you you couldn't stay friends with Jacob? That you never decided to stop being friends with Jacob?
Kind of.
Jonathan backed off, sensing Derek beginning to hedge, and he moved to a new topic.
The day of the murder, you said you saw Jacob before school and again in English class right after school started?
Yes.
But there was no indication that he had been involved in any kind of struggle?
No.
No blood?
Just the little spot on his hand.
No scratches, no torn clothes, nothing like that, no mud?
No.
In fact, it never even occurred to you, looking at Jacob in English class that morning, that he might have been involved in anything on the way to school?
No.
When you later came to the conclusion that Jacob might have committed the murder, as you suggested here, did you take that into account? That after a bloody, fatal knife attack, Jacob somehow emerged without a drop of blood on him, without so much as a scratch? Did you think about that, Derek?
Kind of.
Kind of?
Yes.
You said Ben Rifkin was a bigger kid than Jacob, bigger and tougher.
Yes.
But still, Jacob came out of this struggle without a mark on him?
Derek did not answer.
Now, you said something about Jacob grinning when the lockdown was announced.
Did other kids grin? Is it natural enough for a kid to grin when there's excitement, when you're nervous?
Probably.
It's just something kids do sometimes.
I guess.
Now, the knife you saw, Jacob's knife, just to be clear, you have no idea whether that was the knife that was used in the murder?
No.
And Jacob never said anything to you about intending to use the knife on Ben Rifkin because of the bullying?
Intending? No, he didn't say that.
And when he showed the knife to you, it never occurred to you that he planned to kill Ben Rifkin? Because if it did, you would have done something about it, right?
I guess.
So as far as you knew, Jacob never had a plan to kill Ben Rifkin.
A plan? No.
Never talked about when or how he was going to kill Ben Rifkin?
No.
Then later he just sent you the story?
Yeah.
He sent you a link by email, you said?
Yes.
Did you save that email?
No.
Why not?
It didn't seem smart. I mean, from Jacob's point of view.
So you deleted the email because you were protecting him?
I guess.
Can you tell me, of all the details in that story, was there anything that was new to you? Anything you didn't already know from either the web or from news stories or from other kids talking?
No, not really.
The knife, the park, the 3 stab wounds, that was all well known by then, wasn't it?
Yes.
Hardly a confession, then, is it?
I don't know.
And did he say in the email that he'd written the story or just found it?
I don't remember exactly what the email said. I think it was just like, dude, check this out, or something like that.
But you're sure Jacob told you he wrote the story, not that he just read it?
Pretty sure.
Pretty sure?
Pretty sure, yeah.
Jonathan went on in this way for some time, doing what he could, shaving away and shaving away at Derek Yu's testimony, scoring what points he could. Who knows what the jurors were really making of it? All I can tell you is that the half-dozen jurors who were furiously taking notes during Derek's direct testimony had put down their pens now. Some were no longer even looking at him. They had dropped their eyes to their laps. Maybe Jonathan had won the day, and they had decided to discount Derek's testimony entirely. But it did not seem that way. It seemed like I had been fooling myself. And for the first time, I began to imagine in realistic terms what it would be like when Jacob was in Concord Prison. Chapter 35. Argentina. Driving home from court that day, I was morose, and my sadness infected Jacob and Lori. From the start, I had been the steady one. It upset them, I think, to see me lose hope. I tried to lie for them. I said all the usual things about not feeling too up on a good day or too down on a bad day, about how the prosecution's evidence always looks worse on first sight than it does later, in the context of the whole case, about how juries are impossible to anticipate and we should not read too much into their every little gesture. But my tone gave me away. I thought we had probably lost the case that day. At a minimum, the damage was enough that we would have to present a real defense. It would be foolish to rely on reasonable doubt at this point. The story Jacob had written about the murder read like a confession, and try as he might, Jonathan could not disprove Derek's testimony that Jacob wrote it. I did not admit any of this. There was nothing to gain by telling the truth, so I didn't. All I said to them was that it wasn't a good day. But that was enough. Father O'Leary did not appear to watch over us that night or anyone else. We barbers were left in complete isolation. If we had been shot out into space, we could not have felt more alone. We ordered Chinese food as we had 1,000 times the last few months because China City delivers and the driver speaks so little English that we did not have to feel self-conscious opening the door for him. We ate our boneless spare ribs and General Gao's chicken in near silence, then slunk off to opposite corners of the house for the evening. We were too sick of the case to talk about it anymore, but too obsessed with it to talk about anything else. We were too gloomy for the idiocies of TV. Suddenly our lives seemed finite, and much too short to waste, and too distracted to read. Around 10, I went into Jacob's room to check on him. He lay on his back on the bed. "You okay, Jacob?"
"Not really."
I went over and sat on the side of the bed. He hoisted his butt over to make room, but Jake was getting so big there was hardly enough space for both of us. He used to lie right on my chest for naps when he was a baby. He had been no bigger than a loaf of bread. He rolled onto his side and propped his head on his hand.
Dad, can I ask you something? If you thought things were looking bad, like the case was about to go the wrong way, would you tell me?
Why?
No, not why, just would you tell me?
Yeah, I guess so.
Because it wouldn't make sense to... Well, if I took off, what would happen to you and Mom?
We'd lose all our money.
They'd take away the house?
Eventually, we put it up as security on your bail.
He considered this.
It's just a house, I told him. I wouldn't miss it. It doesn't matter as much as you.
Yeah, but still, where would you guys live?
Is this what you've been lying here thinking about?
A little bit.
Lori came to the door. She folded her arms and leaned on the doorpost. I said, where would you go?
Buenos Aires.
Buenos Aires? Why there?
It just sounds like a cool place.
Says who?
There was an article about it in the Times. It's the Paris of South America.
I didn't know South America had a Paris.
It's in South America, right?
Yeah, it's in Argentina. You may want to do a little more research before you run off there.
Is there a, what do you call it, a treaty like a fugitive treaty?
An extradition treaty? I don't know. I guess that'd be another thing you'd want to check out first.
Yeah, I guess so.
How would you pay for the ticket?
I wouldn't. You would.
And a passport? You surrendered yours, remember?
I'd get a new one somehow.
Just like that? How?
Lori came and sat on the floor beside the bed and stroked his hair. He'd sneak across the border into Canada, and he'd get a Canadian passport.
Not sure it's actually that easy, but okay. So what would you do once you got to Buenos Aires, which we know is in Argentina?
Lori said, he'd dance the tango.
Her eyes were wet. Do you know how to dance the tango, Jacob?
Not exactly.
Not exactly, he says.
Not exactly like meaning not at all.
He laughed. Well, you can get tango lessons in Buenos Aires, I would think.
Lori said, in Buenos Aires, everybody knows the tango.
You'll need someone to dance the tango with, won't you?
He smiled shyly. Lori said, Buenos Aires is filled with beautiful women who dance the tango. Beautiful, mysterious women. Jacob will have his pick.
Is that true, Dad? Lots of beautiful women in Buenos Aires?
That's what I hear.
He lay back and laced his fingers behind his head.
This is sounding better and better.
What will you do there when you get done dancing the tango, Jake?
Go to school, I guess.
I pay for that, too?
Of course.
And after school?
I don't know. Maybe I'll be a lawyer like you.